But the weather was still good.
The weather was just beautiful. And I managed to get over to the Air Force officer, wear two hats for a week, and I went over to El Arish and spent a week over in Egypt, too. So I had to look around and see how the other half were living over there. I was glad I was in Athens. Thank you very much.
Didn't like Egypt,
huh? Well, yeah, it wasn't bad, but the... you know, I was living in a pretty comfortable hotel in Athens. Over there, they were living in tents in the desert. You know, so there's a bit of difference. I've had my share of discomfort in the Army, but yeah.
If you have your choice, that.
Oh well.
Yeah.
Sure. A lot depends on what you're doing, of course. And I envy the. We had the ones I stayed with, of course, was an armored reconnaissance squadron that was there, and of course I envied them their role, and would have given my bottom dollar to have been with them. You know, it was only a 6-month tour, mm-hmm. and despite some of the physical discomfort aspects, it was a good, challenging operational environment. And if you put an officer in command of troops in an operational theater, it doesn't really matter what he's doing, he's learning something, mm-hmm. you know, and... particularly if there's out there, if there's people shooting at you occasionally, or mines going off under your vehicle, and that, you learn a lot of useful lessons. So, yeah. So anyway, that was the autumn of 58, yes?
I guess it goes without saying that your wife wasn't with you.
Oh, no. She was not one of those. This was just a single, unaccompanied tour for... it was just slightly under 3 months. But it was really an excellent opportunity. But when I did take my wife out there 20 years later, of course, I was able to give her conducted tours around there. I knew what they were for you. Yeah.
Greek food is marvelous.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. That was a great experience. And of course, in those days, too, it was before milk pasteurization and that sort of thing. So you had to be rather careful of what you ate. TB was rampant and that sort of thing. And of course, you didn't dare touch the water.
Mm-hmm.
And, there were more than enough compensations because a lot of historic sites and so forth, you could you had far more freedom of movement in than you do now, and it was before the the acid rain and started etching away the faces of the statuary and that sort of thing, and so it was probably a better time to see. I was a little disappointed when I met back 20 years later to see the depredations in a relatively short period, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When you're dealing with buildings that are thousands of years old.
It kind of makes you think about the Greek government, how they're fighting to get the marble back from
London. That's a political thing. What's her name, never on Sunday?
Melina
Mercury, and you know, she's making her thing out of that. But really, the Greeks would be damn lucky that stuff's in London. Because it's a hell of a lot better shape than the stuff that's left in Greece, you know. And if they, if the Elgin marbles hadn't been preserved and kept over there and everything, we wouldn't have as nearly good, because the others were left there. The naiads, the Porch of the Maidens, one of those is in London. When I was there in the 50s, those maidens were still out there. Being etched away, and when I was there 20 years later, they were just then being removed, and there were plaster reproductions going up there because they'd reached such a stage of deterioration that they were taking them down, moving them into a museum.
Mm-hmm.
But by that time, of course, the damage had been done, and it's just shocking to see the way it etches away the marble. Yeah, cuts right into it.
Would you be in uniform the entire time you were in Egypt?
I was in uniform when they when I went out to the airport when the there's the ferry when the weekly flights came in,
mm-hmm.
And I'd be in uniform then, so I could be recognized and that sort of thing. The rest of the time I was in civilian clothes.
So the Greek people would see you as simply a tourist.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's all. Yeah.
Were you received fairly well in Athens?
Oh yeah, reasonably well. Like most of Europe, you can always get along with English. Generally, the people who were of an age where they had been educated before the Second World War had French as their second language because the French had certain cultural inroads in there in that era. After the war, the second language became English, mm-hmm. as it has in virtually all of Europe. And so any younger person could always speak English. And of course, most of the shopkeepers and so forth were, like most Europeans, fluent in many languages, and so they could get along.
So you came back to Ottawa as?
Back to Ottawa. I was still a lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
And I was promoted the following spring. It was the spring of 59. I finally went up to the rank of captain. And I've forgotten the date, but it's not significant, I guess. And at about the same time I was promoted, I got my posting to Calgary again, back to the regiment. This is quite normal. We usually went back once in each rank.
Mm-hmm.
And come the summertime, June or July or so, and just slightly less than the 2 years again, off we went. And we drove out with the family. Arrived in Calgary, and for the first 3 months or so that I was there, I went into a battle captain's appointment in one of the other squadrons, not the squadron I'd been in last time. This was happened to be in C squadron.
Mm-hmm.
And so I explained what the battle captain does. And
what squadron were you in?
C squadron, that time. And I hadn't been on the ground much more than a month or so before I had to go up and run a gunnery course up at Wainwright. And this was in October, and oh boy, was it cold. Oh, that temperature dropped down to about minus 20 Fahrenheit and stayed that way for about the 2 weeks that we were firing.
Mm-hmm.
We had to keep the tanks running all the time or everything freeze right up. And the ammunition, of course, your number of defective rounds would increase, you know, as with the cold temperature and so forth. And because we were reaching the limitations of the temperature zone that the tanks and the ammunition and so forth were designed to function at. You know, they were designed essentially for Northern Europe, and you don't run into temperatures like that in Northern Europe. So when you get to sustain cold temperature like that, you have to compensate. So,
okay, now tell me this now. You've been away from the regiment for about 4 years, I guess.
Yeah.
How have they changed? Were they re-equipped with new tanks or weaponry?
By this time they had Centurions. But then, of course, I'd had the advantage because I was on Centurions before I left Meaford.
Yeah.
So I was just coming back to one of my old tanks again. So, there wasn't... and, of course, I'd kept current with my Part 2 examinations because, of course, I'd had to be tested in... tank gunnery and driving and maintenance and so forth and that. The driving and maintenance course that I'd taken and the instructor's course, that was taken on Centurion tank.
Mm-hmm.
So here I was on the tank that I'd been trained on. So that was fine. It worked out fine. And at that time, it was the same tank, the Mark III. It had the same gun. It still had a 20-pounder on it. And many of the improvements that came along later hadn't started filtering up the line at that stage, or down the line.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was still a fairly basic tank.
Were there teething troubles with the tank, or?
Oh, no. The tank was developed right near the end of the war by the British, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mark I Centurion, in fact, fought during the latter months of the war in Europe. So they were able to try it out in action and get some readout on it, and then improvements took place. And the Canadian version included a different radio set than the British were using and a few things like that. So it was the Mark III, was the Canadian one. That
mm-hmm.
was
the basic one. Yeah. And needless to say, it was a great step up from the Sherman.
Oh, the difference in the world. The difference between staying at the Ritz or staying at the local flea pit, you know, as far as comfort was concerned. Well, relatively speaking, it was gasoline powered, so therefore it ran warmer, and you had a good heating system in it, so you could keep relatively warm.
Mm-hmm.
Much more room to move around in the turret, much better layout. You even had a brew pot to brew up your tea, you know, an electric kettle that hooked into it, and so all kinds of and
you said it's gas,
gasoline powered, yeah.
As opposed to diesel.
Yeah.
Now, which would be safer?
Well, the diesel is less combustible. It's safer in many respects, but there it all depends on what you mean by safety. If you mean if you're penetrated by a shell, is it going to burn faster than the diesel? Well, probably yes. It's probably more apt to catch fire. But you know, if you're burning gasoline or burning diesel fuel, there's not that much.
I suppose you've got more protection with the Centurion as opposed to the diesel.
Yeah, so better armor protection.
Yeah.
The other aspect of safety I was going to mention is that one of the disadvantages of diesel engines is that if you've been idling in a firing position, sort of thing, unless the driver is very, very well trained when he starts to move out of there, if he guns the engines, you get two great big white plumes of exhaust about. And boy, from a safety point of view, that's deadly as far as another tank is concerned, because it's going to spot you right away and shoot at you. So you didn't have quite the same exhaust problem in the Centurion. And so from a safety point of view, that aspect of safety was much better. It certainly had much better armored protection. And and it had a more powerful, bigger gun on it, and a very much more stable gun platform to fire from.
Mm-hmm.
Better all-around tank, yeah.
What about reliability of engines? Because we're looking at a British engine, which British engines have got a bad reputation, and American engines have got a very good reputation for
them. Yeah, it all depended. In this case, it turned out to be considerably more reliable for a variety of reasons. The Sherman that we were using had twin diesel engines. And while the individual diesel engine was quite adequate and quite reliable, it was the gearing and clutching problem to get both of those engines driving one common drive shaft.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you were getting uneven wear, and you had two clutches, they're always required setting up and that sort of thing. It gave you the advantage if one engine broke down, you could hobble back on one engine, but. The engine in the Centurion was essentially the British Rolls-Royce Maryland aircraft engine.
The old Spitfire.
Yeah, that's right. That's what it was. So it was extremely reliable. It just ran like a bomb. The only trouble was, of course, it was built for an aircraft. So all the spark plugs and everything were down underneath.
This made it a little tricky.
Changing the spark plugs and that was about a two-day job, sort of thing. Well, you had to get down underneath the darn thing. You had to get down under the engine. Remember, the engine's mounted completely in an armored compartment.
Mm-hmm.
So it was never designed to operate. It was a case of making do at the end of the war and using up this great surplus they had of aircraft engines. And so the British, in their indomitable fashion, said, fine, we'll take all these spare aircraft engines and put them into the tanks. And that's just what they did. So they weren't running off a high-octane fuel. They changed the carburation system and a few things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it was a very good, reliable engine, and they had little or no problem with it. And the problems were more with the final drive mechanisms into the driving wheels, that, the sprockets that operated the track.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a very complicated gear system in it, which was called an epicyclic gear train, which was run off a system of braking one side of putting a brake, working brake shoes on one side of the gear train in order to increase the speed on the other, sort of thing. And in fact, under certain circumstances, you could do what they called a neutral turn, where you could get one track turning one way and the other track turning the other, so you could just turn right around on a spot.
Mm-hmm.
Nice little innovations. Not that you always use them very often, because very often if your track wasn't the right tension, you'd end up throwing your track. So
it was non-productive that way. Anyway.
Were there any bad points about the tank that you noticed?
No, because bad points are in a tank are relative. We were comparing it to our last one, which was a Sherman, and there were so many improvements that, sure, there were... There were a lot of shortcomings at the time. We realized that if we were going into an NBC environment, of course the tank wasn't. There was no way of sealing the tank, and you gained a certain amount of protection from the additional armor protection on it. But for anything like nuclear contamination or chemical warfare, because the Russians had and still have a very strong chemical capability.
Mm-hmm.
And so our chemical thing was put on your gas mask and continue to fight your tank, And well, that became a problem too, because a lot of the instruments and sights and so forth weren't always compatible with use with a gas mask. Mm-hmm. You know, the gunner had difficulty getting his head up to the brow pad and his gun sight with his respirator on.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were certain built-in shortcomings that way. And but
eventually, were the Centurions adapted for NBCs?
The Chieftain, which followed the Centurion, was. We didn't go with the Chieftain. We held off, and we went for the German Leopard tank later on.
Which had NBC?
Yes, okay. To a certain extent. Yeah.
Well, you equivocate there. Do you mean that?
Well, it. Yeah. We could take a time. We spend about an hour talking about this. The reason I can't make it too simple because I know too much more about it. When I later went over to the British War Office, when I had my exchange posting over there, the chief in tank was just coming in, and I had it on my desk. I was the officer that was the expert on the chieftain, as well as the centurion and a couple of others. But the chieftain was my main concern, and so at that time we were. Primarily concerned with improvements, which included NBCW protection, and
what does W stand for?
Warfare, nuclear, biological, and chemical. So there were various things that we were doing then with the tank, and also there's always a trade-off, and I'll get into this on progression and the tank development and production and. Issue into service, and meanwhile, while all that's going on, you're working on the next tank.
Mm-hmm.
That's because it takes about 8 to 10 years to develop and produce a tank.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like an automobile.
There's
a good deal more research and development has to go into it, and so forth. And you've got such an investment in the first place that you want to make sure that you're going to get your money's worth out of the one that you put in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always the breakoff period of whether you keep it long enough to. So that it becomes completely obsolete, or whether it's still saleable to a third world country, or perhaps even another NATO ally for a role which is perhaps not quite as operational as the one envisioned in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are various trade-offs that have to be. Many of these, of course, are politically motivated, and quite naturally so, because of course they affect. Defense production and arms sales and that sort of thing. So,
were we considering buying the Chieftain as a replacement or as a complementary tank to the Centurion?
Well,
because it was a different kind of tank design in that it was a heavier tank, bigger tank.
Yeah, it was only a little heavier and only a little bigger.
It had a lower silhouette as well. Didn't it?
A little lower silhouette. Was much improved. Had separated ammunition, which was a safety factor, which made it. A little safer. It had a tremendously improved gun on it as far as performance.
That was the 120?
120, yeah. And, the timing was bad, and as usual, of course, we were military paupers on the equipment side. We can't replace our equipment. The political solution in Canada is, well, you're going to lose a few soldiers anyway, so you might as well keep the tank a little longer, at the time that we should have been considering shifting to Chieftain and getting rid of our Centurions, priorities in military spending had shifted to otherwise. By this time, unification was upon us. And with unification came one of the major disadvantages, and that was the unification of the military expenditures.
Mm-hmm.
And it meant that the slices of money that went to the equipment pie came out of the equipment pie had to be divided between our Navy, Army, and Air Force, and of course you're trying to compare apples and oranges here because
mm-hmm.
You needed more military equipment because there was more of it, but it was cheaper and smaller as opposed to a ship or as opposed to an aircraft. And in some cases, of course, such as aircraft, when they're buying this straight off the shelf, then at the end of the fiscal year, and there's a few million left, so you go and buy up an aircraft, like that.
Mm-hmm.
Easily done.
Mm-hmm.
Army, Navy didn't necessarily have that advantage. And so...
And I suppose you really have to look at the political implications as well.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah, no question about it, sure.
Who thought that we really needed tanks for Defense of Canada? The only reason we need tanks is for NATO commitment.
Yeah, and there's the other aspects, is that at the end of the war, of course, due to the various political pressures, we had been building tanks, but we stopped, and we had been building ships, and we stopped a lot of that.
So what
we continued to build aircraft. And so there's a vested interest in the aircraft industry in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a strong political motivation towards keeping the Air Force up to date. If you can't do it with Canadian aircraft, well, then you're going to do it with another aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's way into another field. Your question was the chief to have any major defects? Well, relatively few compared to the old Sherman. It was much improved, and we were just delighted with it in those days. So it was a great improvement.
How many did we have at that point? Did we buy a?
We had. I can only give you in rough figures. A regiment's complement in Canada at that time was about 65 tanks. We had. At that time, we only had two regiments at that time. And we had about the same number, roughly, at the Armored Corps School. Then ones for training at the Ramey School for mechanical training and that sort. Certain amount that go for testing. So probably 150 plus a war reserve, probably another 50 or something like that. Probably 200, somewhere around that, I would guess.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm sorry. That's all we had at that time. Yeah, just thinking back. And
were they all Mark III's?
They were all Mark III's, yeah. Yeah, we never did buy any Mark I's. We started with the Mark III's. We got our first ones in, as I mentioned, when I was up in Mayford in 51. And so they were coming in steadily after that.
You mentioned we had the 20-pounder. Now, is that the same as the famous 105, or is it?
Yeah. If you look at the shells, those shell casings behind you, those two brass lamps are made out of 105 casings, and for outward appearance sake, they look almost identical.
They're much larger than I expected them to be. I mean,
yeah.
How many shells would there be in a...
About 65.
With a good selection of different kinds of shells?
Yeah.
When I first came in,
we were using Sherman, 75 millimeter, and that's a 75 millimeter. That's empty. There's nothing in the casing.
How much more weight would there be with the? How much more weight?
About another 10 pounds of charge in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so those are fairly light. These things weigh about 45 pounds, which doesn't sound like very much, except when you're in a turret of a tank and you're bent down, pulling this up out of the floor, and then you have to turn around, shift it, and load the gun.
And how many would you be
65 times.
And the heat inside of those suckers could be...
We got a lot of short, muscular loaders in the Armored Corps. Yeah.
Did you really look out for that, the height of people? Because I'm 6'2", and I would think that I wouldn't be too good inside a tank.
Well, it never become too much of a problem with us, because we were going for medium tanks, so they tend to be fairly roomy.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you're going into light tanks or into reconnaissance vehicles that you have a slight problem, and we had to watch fairly very closely. A lot depended on the nationality that was producing the tank that you were buying.
Mm-hmm.
See, the median height in the UK, I think, is 5'4". Or was back in the early 70s, was back in the late 60s, early 70s, was about 5'4".
So they could expect 5 feet.
So you, the majority were in that height range, whereas the median height in Canada that was about 5'10",
mm-hmm.
5'9", something like that. So that was, it became quite a difference. And part of your studies, of course, that went on were done by our various research people, of course, involved the problems of fitting big people into small tanks and vice versa. And it was more of a problem, of course. I ran into this more over in the UK, where we were actively designing tanks and this sort of thing. So the average height of the individual had to be calculated in designing the amount of space that you had for it.
Mm-hmm.
We ran into the problem primarily when we started getting into lighter vehicles.
Like the Piranha and things like that?
Mm-hmm.
Like the Piranha, for example?
Yes, that sort of thing, because that was based on a initially we were thinking about buying a British light tank, which really was just too small for Canadians.
Scorpion?
Boy, yeah. And we eventually bought the Scorpion turret, but we put it on another chassis,
mm-hmm.
and so it was a combination sort of thing. But there's no way you could get the average Canadian comfortably into those light tanks. So that's where the problem is. As I said, up to now we hadn't run into it because we're using medium tanks, and they tended to be fairly roomy.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly the Centurion had a good deal more room in it than the. Than the Sherman, with a possible exception of the driver's compartment.
You're looking at a weight of next to 20 tons, aren't you, in comparison to the two? Centurion's about 55.
Well, the Centurion was about 55. The Sherman was ran around 45.
Was it 45?
So it was, depending on, there were a lot of factors in here, whether you're talking about the thing loaded fully and so forth, and operationally equipped and so forth. So,
Let's talk about the fire control system of the Centurion, if we can.
Yeah.
Was it easier than the and better than
mm-hmm.
the Sherman?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What sort of technical improvements were?
Well, the big improvement was the power traverse and power elevation.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have power elevation in the Sherman. It was all hand operated with turning wheels.
And the gunner would be
and,
doing that as well.
The gunner had to do his own elevation and corrections by hand. He did have power traverse on a control,
mm-hmm.
and it was electric, but it was a slow one. The Chieftain had a two-speed one, so you had a fast one. It was a heavy draw on the battery, so it only used it in operational emergencies, but you really turned it around when you had to.
Mm-hmm.
And it had power elevation and depression. It also had a much, much better stabilization system in it, and that you could, what you do, it operated off a gyroscope, and you warm this thing up, and before you started off cross country, you could aim your gun at an object, and regardless of how the tank moved up and down and turned, the gun would always stay aimed at that object. Now,
how was it based? Was it a computer system, or was it radar, or what?
No, it was based on a gyro compass,
mm-hmm.
and it was all with hydraulics, and mechanically operated through servo pumps that provide the hydraulic pressure and raised and depressed it,
mm-hmm.
and it was very good. It was never designed for accurate shooting on the move. But you used it with high explosive ammunition, or you used it with machine gun ammunition. The whole idea was to send enough of shrapnel around the enemy's ears that he wouldn't stick his head up and shoot at you. You
mm-hmm.
know, preventing the little fella getting up with a handheld anti-tank weapon was just ideal. That's one of the main purposes, of course, was that sort of approach. So. From a gunnery point of view, of course, it was much improved and had a much greater range and much better accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were delighted with that aspect of it. We had a slightly improved radio set in it. Well, much improved. It was a Canadian 29 set, which was an improvement over the old 19 that we had. And a bit more reliable and a little bit better range and better B-set communications. You normally had three radio sets in the tank, and it would have helped if you had 3 ears too, but you only had two, so you had to two headsets on as a rule, or some sort of a system whereby you listened on one set and your operator listened on the other, and then you kept one ear clear so you could shout back and forth to one another, and that was that sort of arrangement. No wonder we all went deaf.
Can I ask you this?
Yeah.
How did the tank compare, in your eyes, to the Russian, the Joseph Stalin IIs, which I think were out of that time?
Well, I don't think we were into the JS series yet. Russians were their primary tank was still I think they were getting into the T-60 at the time. They still had a lot of T-54s about, and most of the Iron Curtain countries had the T-54s. The Russians were in the T-60s, and there's no question about it that the Centurion was a better tank than the T-60. The T-60 didn't even have power traverse on it.
Really?
Yeah. There's no crew comfort in the T-60. Mm-hmm. And it was a very rudimentary tank. It had a good low profile. Didn't have as good armor protection. Speed, well, speed becomes relevant if you're talking cross-country speed, because you can't really do much more than about 20 miles an hour across country. Mm-hmm. And arrive at the other end in a state where you can do anything, you know, because otherwise you're shaken up to such an extent. But for road movement or something like that, it probably had a little edge on speed.
Well, I do know that if one analyzes the Arab Israeli conflicts, be they 66 or 67, mm-hmm. you see quite clearly that the Israeli Centurion tanks just dominate the battlefield.
Oh yeah, no question about it. Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think the Russians,
they had much better range and much better accuracy. They could start engaging at much further range. They had better gun sights, better equipment, that sort of thing, better ammunition,
mm-hmm.
and it showed. And of course, that's always been part of the NATO philosophy that you can defend with a fewer number of tanks. Well, it's part of the 1-3 defensive ratio, but when you couple that with the fact that your tanks can engage at maybe 800 or even 1,000 yards further than the enemy tanks can, that gives you a pretty significant advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they've got to, where you can shoot at them and they can't shoot back.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that's always been part of the philosophy, of course. And so they were starting. As the Israeli conflict came in, of course, and they were able to get hold of Russian tanks for the first time then, and then conduct trials where they shot at them and discovered their weak points and the penetration aspects, and they rebuilt many of them and drilled them and found out their good and bad points. But
would you be actively studying them as an officer?
Oh yes, you had to know your enemy, and know about who the potential enemy was, and you had to know his equipment. And it was important that you knew how he fought and so forth, and his philosophy is quite different. Their officer training is different, or was at that time. I don't know to what extent it may have changed now. But our lowest combat level was the troop, and in fact, often we broke down, and that was four tanks. You could even subdivide that into a two-tank. You never worked less than two tanks together for various tactical reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But the lowest entity was a troop, and that was commanded by a troop officer, a troop leader, and the rank lieutenant. And he had certain latitude and certain things he could do within the squadron boundaries of operations and that sort of thing, and certain things he was expected to do. Russians didn't operate like that. Russians never broke down below squadron level, roughly 16 to 20 tanks, and that was the smallest entity. And nobody below the squadron commander, or the company commander, tank company, could command that organization or had the facility to command it by communications.
Mm-hmm.
And so
was it the philosophy that more is better, or was it a question of
the amount of time they had to train their people and to what level they could train their officers, whether it was a question of a combination of a time factor or sheer numbers or a question of native intelligence, I don't know, or maybe a combination of all three.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, for reasons best known to the Russians, that was the level that they trained down to in their tanks. And so needless to say, of course, the desirable thing in a combat situation, of course, is that if you can knock out the Russian tank company commander, you'd virtually wiped out a tank company, because none of them were trained to fight their tanks as individual tanks. They always fought as a company.
Now, could you find out the company commander by pennant or some other...
Except pennants aren't usually flown in wartime. It looks brave, you know, and pictures and that sort of thing. That's a dead giveaway. It's usually the number of antennae that are coming out of the...
That's usually
the way you find out. Or the location of the tank. You don't lead a tank organization from the front. You lead it sort of central, and if anything, towards the rear. Because in the front, you're liable to get pinned down and can't move and can't maneuver. If you're to the rear, you've got the whole, you can see everything that's happening all around you and in front of you, and you're not, somebody else is looking after your rear. And so you want to be in a position where you can see all of your tanks, both at the troop squadron and at the squadron level. Above squadron level, there are too many tanks to see, so regimental commander's never in that position. He exercises control more from a central rear location, usually it's a more of a function of communications than visual control. And
so you're saying that the Russians stated a particular manner of in the formation, so you could actually pick him up fairly easily, and it was your doctrine.
Yeah, tanks fight in certain ways and have certain means of individual or mutual protection, and if you can watch a tank formation moving across the country, it doesn't.
Now, sir, I'm very close to the end of the tape.
We can finish it off. Yeah. And or do you want to? Are you finished?
We're almost out of tape now. That's fine.
All right. Okay. That's fine. Yeah.
Would you mind if we got together another time?
Sure. Yeah. That's fine. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I know we sort of got off on a tangent here, but it's interesting for me.
That's fine. You? Okay. That's fine. Yeah. No, it's your tape, and
but it's your time.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's okay.
Thank you.
I'll wait.